gather around and launch this fascinating presentation on a really topical issue of innovations in finance and conservation. I think all of us are constantly struggling with that challenge of how do we actually finance all the conservation work that needs to be done. So I'm really pleased to introduce Adam Gibbons, who is a ECM alum, so an alumni of the Environmental Change and Management Master's course here at ECI.
Yeah.
That was in 2007?
10 years ago, yeah.
10 years ago, yes. Time flies. And since then, you've been working with the Rainforest Alliance and their climate change program with PricewaterhouseCoopers, and now in this new innovative finance company,
Althea.
Althea, yeah. Thank you. So without further ado, I'll hand the floor to you to talk about your ideas in financing conservation.
Great. Thank you, Connie. Thanks, everyone, for joining. It's Friday afternoon and freezing, so appreciate coming out. It's really nice to be here. Say, after 10 years ago, I was sat in these seats doing my master's, and I hadn't really planned where I was going to go when I entered the master's or where I was going to go when I came out, but you know, the perspective I can share with you today from 10 years of working in this space comes from a couple of years spent at Rainforest Alliance, New York headquartered environmental NGO, where I was the manager of the climate program there, so trying to integrate climate change across the forestry and agriculture strands of what they do. I then moved on to PwC, PricewaterhouseCoopers, known as one of the big accountancy firms, but they actually had a team of, I think it's around 150 people when I started, in the sustainability and conservation team just in London. So I got some really interesting insights there, having worked Rainforest Alliance more at the ground level, sort of moved up, giving more strategic and financial advice to both donor and recipient governments in the land use and forest conservation space, and then also advising big multinationals, you know, the sorts of people who would go to a company like PwC for environmental advice. I spent some time then with Winrock International, American agency, going back to my science roots, helping more on the quantification of the impacts and benefits of doing work in climate change mitigation related to land use. And then I spent the last 4 years with Althea Ecosphere. So we are an impact investment platform. We manage a number of funds that invest into activities in the conservation, climate change, and ever-expanding spaces in this land use, in this impact arena, which I'll come on to talk about. What I'll do today is just give you a quick overview of conservation finance, just to set the scene, put some big numbers out there to give some context to what we're trying to do, and talk you through our Althea Climate Fund, which was the first fund that we launched on the platform, and give you a couple of example investments. I'll talk to you a little bit about another fund that we're in the process of launching, specifically on Madagascar, and then about how we're going to try to realize our ambition to raise and mobilize $100 billion for nature over the coming years. So to kick things off, I think the starting position for all of this and why our fund exists, why we're trying to do this, is that conservation is dramatically underfinanced, and we need new ways to drive money towards it. So quantitatively, I'll just break that down. A few stats. I think this is actually from Andrew's organization, GCP, perhaps rebranded it into a Credit Suisse report. But this shows that the spend on biodiversity conservation annually today is around $51 billion. And 39 of that is from donations. Well, 39 is from public donations, so that's from governments. From governments investing in their own activities, or giving subsidies for positive things related to conservation. You got $2 billion from philanthropic donations, although that number might change next year. I don't know if you saw the news yesterday or the day before. There was a Chinese lady, a business lady, who herself donated $1.5 billion for nature conservation. So that number's changing a bit, but there aren't that many billionaires that are that way inclined, unfortunately. So we'll have to keep moving on. We've got another $10 billion that comes from what we class as private sector investment. So this is broken down into investments into green commodities, and then more specifically the markets that are investing in this. So this is like, you know, the carbon offset, biodiversity offset markets, etc. And you'll see that those type of things you might hear about in the space are actually quite small relative to the total spend. It's worth noting, I was a bit disappointed after I dug into the data behind these graphs, that 80% of this money is spent in developed countries, probably most of that in the US and Europe. So this is all like the common agricultural policy subsidies that might be slightly geared towards conservation and things. So really, as we know, that's not where the big, there's plenty of challenges there, but that's not where the big crisis of biodiversity loss is happening today. So some numbers here from Credit Suisse and McKinsey on what might require to actually properly finance conservation, and they believe, having taken a sample of a few papers out there, that we need to increase what we're investing today by 20 or 30 times to reach 300 and 400 billion a year. Now, a portion of that, of course, can come from governments and from the philanthropic sector, but given the political climates and that you're finding in many countries today, I think even if we assume that can be doubled, that's quite generous over the coming years. So that still leaves the gap of 200, 300 billion a year that we need to find additional to what's going on today to channel towards these type of activities. The trends, how well you can see these graphs, but it's the trends that are really important. These are from a different source, from a recent Forest Trends report on conservation finance. And they show that in the top left here, the government investment per year is pretty much stable since the green is 2009 to 13 average, 14 and 15. There's not really been much change in terms of public spending in conservation. But the total is relatively large, 21 billion, compared to the private sector total, which is 6.5 billion over that period. But the important thing is on this graph, the arrows are going up, so we're getting a lot more investment in this space. The one that's really taken off is a sustainable food and fibre, and that's part of the area that we're in, as I'll come to that later, investing in products and commodities. Habitat conservation is a lot lower, obviously harder to make returns out of that unless you've got innovative mechanisms like the REDD+, biodiversity credits, etc., which I'll touch on. Water quality and quantities seem to be even lower. I think that's generally regarded as something the public sector are taking care of, so we're seeing a lot less there. I know there's a water MSC here. If anyone's from that class, I'm sure you'll know a lot more, understand better than me what's going on. But yeah, this is the space that I'll be really talking about today, products and conservation from these areas. So what are we talking about when we say these investments into conservation? Really taking the private sector view now. We'll start down here. This is how we conceptualize it, at least. We have what we'll class broadly as a sustainable enterprise. So this is somebody, it could be a large company, it could be a small to medium enterprise, an SME, could be an NGO, could be a community group or an indigenous peoples group, cooperative. We put them in this bucket of sustainable enterprises that can take finance and do something with it. And the type of activities that we're talking about that can make a difference to conservation on the ground include degraded land restoration, either putting it straight back into conservation use or putting it back into, say, complex agroforestry that has some wildlife and conservation benefits, can create buffers, etc. Talking about sustainable forest management, so ways of working with standing forests, either for timber or for non-timber forest products, and valuing them in their standing form in a sustainable way. It's about sustainable intensification of activities. So a lot of the problems that we're seeing around the world with deforestation are because the models today are around expanding into new areas and cutting down forests. If we can intensify in situ, then we can meet the demand, and we don't need to extensify so much and lose so much of our forest. Thinking beyond the commodities, it's also about ecotourism. We're mentioning it today. We have one small investment in ecotourism, again trying to generate value for nature areas without harming them. And also renewable energy. So in a lot of places, particularly Africa, you'll see a big driver of degradation, and something that's taking people into the forest and causing conservation problems is around sourcing fuel wood. So if you can replace some of these more destructive things with cheaper, cleaner, healthier alternatives, as I'll talk about in one of our examples, then there can be conservation benefits through that as well. So these type of activities, for it to be an investment, have to be kicking off revenue streams. So for us, that's about commodities. So we make money through the volume of those commodities, the additional revenues for quality, and potentially as well certification premiums as well. If you've got Rainforest Alliance, Fair Trade, Organic, etc., it's a tough market, but you can extract small premiums out of those. Also importantly, you can get access to markets, particular supply chains that you might not be able to get access to without those eco-credentials. And also then obviously ecotourism revenues and payments for fuel services. So all these activities lead to impact outcomes on the ground. Now, we are a fund that looks more broadly at impact. I think you could, the conservation ones are really the ecosystems and species that we look at. I know there's at least some people who are really interested in impacts today. I'm not going to spend a lot of time going into that. We have an amazing impact report online. We've run one for 2 years now. I think if you want to read up one interesting thing about Ophelia afterwards, I'd go on and download that impact report. So that really explains our methods and impacts over the last just couple of years that we've been doing this. But we look more broadly, so we're also looking at livelihoods. So we're giving people long-term employment that's paying above minimum wage, you know, living wages, good jobs with possibilities for moving forward. We want to be inclusive, so we measure how we're getting not just those most eligible for work involved, but how do we get more traditionally marginalised people involved, so Indigenous communities, could be women in one case, getting them on so that there's a fair distribution of the benefits from our work. We're an impact investment fund, or we run impact investment funds, so we are looking for profits, but we think they should be fair. So we're trying to make sure that when benefits are received from the activities that we're doing, there's a fair spread amongst the stakeholders that we're involved in creating them. And finally, is the clear in the Alphelia Climate Fund that I'll come to talk about, is climate's the big reason for one of the big drivers behind our first fund. So we measure very carefully the impact in terms of avoided emissions, particularly if you avoided deforestation and soil carbon benefits. So the thing about driving this money here is, how do we get the money from these people who are in the investor group, which is your high net worth individuals, retail investors, institutional investors, how do you get that to the companies? And that generally has to flow through some intermediary vehicles like bonds, equity funds, debt funds, SPVs, etc. And this is where we sit, and what I'll talk a bit more today about how we're trying to connect all these things up. But before I do that, we've got to ask the question, why isn't this all happening already? So what's the problem? Like, why aren't we getting this the money flowing that we need? And if I go to conservation conferences, you tend to hear people saying, well, there's no money, we can't get access to it, that's the problem. You go to the banking finance conference and they're like, we've got billions that's earning like nothing in the bank in cash, we'd love to invest, but there's nothing to invest in, you know. So we hear these two sides of the coin in the world that I circulate in. So I'll just go through those two a bit and see which of those is true. So I think on the money side, it's no secret, as I said, companies like Apple alone have billions and billions just sat there earning little to no interest. There is money. So if you take, so Credit Suisse and McKinsey broke down when looking for this money, where could we find investments for these type of activities? And you have to hold your nose, because these sums of money are quite disgusting, but just ultra and high net worth individuals alone have $46 trillion worth of bankable assets, and that's growing at 8% a year. If we could tap just the new money that they're reinvesting and the growth, that would be $85 billion a year right there in 1%. Now, these people have got rich because they tend to be quite conservative with their money. They're careful. But even in the most careful portfolio, there'll always be alternative investments. And these type of people, I think increasingly as the younger generation takes over management of this type of money, will be looking to have an impact as well, a positive impact. So 1% of that is perhaps not too ambitious. Retail investors, so this is where the rest of our money probably sits. 53 trillion, growing at 2% a year. And again, if we could tap just 1% of that, that's another 65 billion. Now, your institutional investors, so this is like your pension funds and your sovereign wealth, have a similar large number, 62 trillion, growing at 5% of the year. These guys have a lot longer time horizons. They tend to be more patient. They have much bigger ticket sizes. They'll be looking to deploy very large amounts of money. But again, if we could just skim a small percentage of that 1%, we're at 90 billion. So you add all that up, and that's 240 billion a year, out of the 210 to 290 that I said we needed. So whilst these sums seem huge when you break it down, I think the money is there. But this money, whenever they invest it, there'll be very specific risk and return profiles that they're looking for. And generally, that's quite low risk and low return. So that doesn't necessarily marry up with the types of activities that I was talking about there. As I mentioned, they're very conservative. So they'll want to understand the underlying assets. So these are people who've probably been investing in the same thing, be it property or forestry or something, for years and years and years. When you come along with a new idea, they don't understand it. They can't price the risk. And therefore, the conversation on investment can break down. And we need to also hit a scale. These investor groups, they invest in ticket sizes of hundreds or billions, hundreds of millions or billions. These are the scale of investments that they're putting out. And again, connecting that down to your good idea on the ground is part of the big challenge. So let's have a look at the other side of the equation, this argument from the bankers perhaps that there's no opportunities. Well, the political and business opportunities are certainly there. So, I mean, when I was studying here in 2007, that was when Red Plus became part of the UNFCCC officially, with its inclusion in the Bali Action Plan. Over the last years, we've had in 2010 the Consumer Goods Forum, 400 companies signing up to halve deforestation in their supply chains by 2020. TFA 2020, it's another 198 countries and companies and NGOs that have signed up to reduce and eliminate deforestation. Today, when you look at coming at this just from the climate perspective, the UNFCCC, there's 117 countries that have quantitative targets for reducing emissions from land use, which really converts to avoiding degradation and forest degradation and deforestation. So there's plenty, and these are just a few. I'm sure you'll all have lots more examples, but there's plenty of commitment on the side of businesses and governments to do this, at least at the highest levels, if not in a day-to-day operational sense. There's also very real resource constraints. So if your business model has been going to Indonesia, tearing down primary rainforest, draining peat and planting palm oil, well, that's coming to an end because there's not much of it left, one, if you wanted to keep going, but otherwise it's being clamped down on by the government. And also these political and business commitments that I've mentioned don't allow most of the big off-takers to touch that stuff anymore. So there's a real business models need to change. So the money that's been flowing into those types of activities before needs somewhere else to go, and there will generate opportunities on the ground. This brought up this chart, which is from a TFA, Tropical Forest Alliance, assessment of their performance in achieving their ambitions. And they looked at the amount of investment that would be needed to enable sustainable land use in the tropics by 2020. It came up with this huge number, hundreds of billions. But what's interesting, I thought, was that two-thirds of that is all about improving productivity. And if you're improving productivity, that's a profitable activity. You know, this is something you can make a business model out of, whether it's intensifying cattle, rehabilitating degraded land, or boosting yields for smallholders or big companies. So there's plenty of profitable opportunities there in theory. There's also lots of innovation on the ground. So you can't go to a conservation conference without tripping over successful pilots and new schemes and innovations. There's lots of things that are happening. Lots of nice brochures and all this stuff. There's loads. So what's going on? Well, in terms of an investment model, the first thing is track record. When you put on your banker suit, the things you're looking for, okay, show me the track record. You know, I want to see your last 10 years finances. Well, that's not much good if you're just coming out of a pilot, because obviously you don't have it. So there's something there about lack of track record and just experience in the space. It's also the ticket size. It's quite a disconnect between the hundreds of millions up here and then the 1 to 5 million that people want for like a 1 to 5 year expansion of the work they're doing on the ground with smallholder yield increases or connected to some conservation or something. It's also really expensive and hard to find these deals. So again, bankers like to sit in offices, read short reports and make quick decisions. That's not how it works when it comes to... That's fine if you want to invest in... even renewables are starting to get to that space now where things are a lot more commodified and standardised. If you want to invest in smallholder agriculture, conservation, REDD+, these type of things, they're just not at that standardised level. Everything takes a lot more due diligence, a lot more work to turn it into a real opportunity. And then the payment for environmental services market, so you know your carbon credits, your biodiversity, payment for water services, etc. These are just getting started. Despite having been around for 10 or 15 years, practically that's still new in relation to the markets that these types of investors are looking at investing in. So this is where I think we come in. So we as an impact investment fund platform are trying to sit in the middle there as a vehicle that can get this money flowing. So our role is to educate investors on both the imperative and the opportunity that exists. And you know, we're not the only ones doing that. There's lots of good NGOs and campaigns pushing them in that direction. So that door's getting easier and easier to push on. We also need to create products that they understand. You know, they don't, these type of scale of investors, they don't want to invest in nice ideas. They need products. They need things that they can put chunks of 10 and 100 million towards. And they want to understand the risk. So we have to identify it and show that we're managing it on their behalf as asset managers. Our role is also to do the legwork. So our funds receive a management fee, and for that we have to go out and find investments. We have to probably do a lot more with our fees than many others do, because there's a lot of ground to cover, a lot of work to do actually on the ground, and then to develop them. So you know, we've been doing this for 4 years now with Althea Climate Fund. We've had over 200 opportunities that we've looked at, and I could say probably I've had a handful of nice business plans and models that have arrived on my desk. Most of them are rather scattered ideas that are forming into a concept, but need quite a lot of work from our side to turn them into that real investable opportunity. And we also play that role in aggregation. So we have to go around the world finding these ideas and packaging them up into something that's of a scale that's of interest to these people. And I think if there was a manager here, it's also about mainstreaming innovation, because all these new ideas are great, but we need to make this sound really boring, because we want investors to go, okay, it's just another one of those, you know, I understand the return, I understand the risk, here's the money. If you're jumping around talking about the innovative nature of it, when they hear innovation, they probably hear risk. So it's about packaging it up and standardizing it so it's something they understand. So what we have today is an impact investment fund, the Althea Climate Fund, of 101 million euros. That came from a blend of public and private sector investors. Some of the main ones are listed here. So on the public side, there's people like EIB, the European Investment Bank, FMO, that's the Dutch Development Bank, and FinFund, the equivalent in FinFund. We've got some civil society money, so the Church of Sweden put some of their resources in. And then we've got private sector money, so Credit Suisse, that comes from some of the high net worth individuals that I mentioned through a notes scheme, AXA, investments. That's the, you know, the pension money, and BNP Paribas as well, the French bank. So we have a blend of investors, as you can probably guess from some of those names that you're familiar with. Some are more interested in the impact side of it, some are more interested in the financial risk side of it. But they're all willing to get on board and get behind this new venture and learn with us as we go. Our investors are actually very active, so they sit on investment expert board panels, advisory panels, particularly the public sector ones, often the ones who are passing us deals, people who've come to them looking for finance, but it's not quite right. So the investors become a real strategic partner of ours. We were also fortunate to get a guarantee from USAID. From the way this works is that what they guarantee at the portfolio is 50% of any losses. So if we invested our 100 million and only got 50 back, we'd have lost 50 million. But USAID would step in and compensate a $25 million loss to our investors. So obviously we hope we're never in that situation to be called on this, but it's like insurance. And having that insurance in place is really important, particularly in getting the private sector guys on board here. So we launched this fund in 2013, which is when I joined at the first close. And our mandate specifically for the Climate Fund is to invest in opportunities that mitigate climate change, have conservation benefits, and also produce sustainable livelihoods on the ground. The way we do that is through investments that kick off revenue streams in terms of payment for environmental services. So that will be carbon credits, mainly related to REDD+, reducing emissions from deforestation and degradation. And also sustainable commodities that could be, well, I'll come on to some examples later, but I'm sure you can imagine. The typical deal size that we do is $5 to $15 million. We're an 8-year fund, so it started in 2013. So, you know, that's roughly for the period that our financing is there. It's around $1 million a year, which I think is quite a manageable amount for people to put to use on the ground. And I'll just say quickly a couple of things about ESG, environmental, social governance, and impact. One of the things that we put front and center of our thesis, the point of our thesis, is to be really strong and push boundaries on environmental and social governance. Because so much of this stuff has not been done right in the financing sector to date, and has been patched up, and people are generally trying to improve. We want to get out there at the front and be the best in class at this stuff. So not just screen to make sure nothing's bad going on, but really set high standards and push people and help them to meet it. So this is just a very high level schematic, but we have our own proprietary environmental social governance policy and standard, and lots of implementation documents that sit behind that. We didn't want to completely reinvent the wheel, so a lot of that is based on the IFC performance standards of the World Bank. When it comes to land use management, we use the Climate Community and Biodiverse Alliance standards for carbon, generally the Verified Carbon Standard, the VCS, and the IFC performance standard itself calls on the ILO, International Labour Organization rules when it comes to labour. We plugged what we perceived as a few gaps for what we were specifically doing with things like mandating rules around benefit sharing, as I mentioned, to make sure there's a fair distribution of the spoils on the side of our investee to those who are participating in the activities. You know, we have exclusion lists, which is quite common. We don't invest in, say, tobacco plants, for example, drugs and that type of thing. We also beefed up anti-bribery policies and also grievance mechanisms to give, make sure everyone involved in our investments has an opportunity to have a say. When it comes to impacts, we've aligned those. You'll probably be able to read much of this, but we've aligned those recently with the SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals. We have the 7 that I mentioned before, so I won't go through it again. Like I said, I'd really recommend if that's your area of interest, have a look in our impact report online. It's something we're proud of, and we've had a lot of positive feedback from our investors so far. But still, like all of this, a lot to learn, and we'll keep pushing the boundaries on that. this is what our portfolio looked like. So I'm not going to have time to go through all the examples, but the takeaway is that we've fully committed our 101 million euro to 13 investments around the world. A bias in Latin America. We have a Latin American office, which obviously is a big help for deal sourcing. I think it's also just been easier to find opportunities in there. The type of things we do, we hit a lot of problems related to land tenure in Africa, because the people are generally distributed through forests, and that can be tricky. Asia, I think, just has felt a long way away without having an office there at the moment. I think there's a lot of potential there for future funds. We've in terms of the counterparties that we've invested in, we're quite proud of the diversity here. So we've invested in NGOs, multimedia enterprises, cooperatives, one government, so the state of Mato Grosso in Brazil, and also one indigenous peoples group in Peru. The thing that connects all these together, probably with the exception of the government one, which is a bit different, but it's their financing needs and the stage of their enterprise. So we're generally looking at people in the growth phase. So it's the people who've done their pilot. They've got a model that can work and to be profitable, can have impact, but they need money to actually take it to scale. But they're also still mature, not mature yet. So they're not ready to go to the bank and just take out a loan at their local bank. But also they either want to or are moving beyond concessional finance or grants. So we rely a lot on grant making in this early part of the growth of companies, and then we take over with our venture capital and growth capital to grow these businesses. So hopefully then we can pass them on to the next set of financiers that are successful. And we have a big diversity in our portfolio in terms of commodities, from cacao to timber to coffee, macuba, it's like a palm oil that can be grown in silver cultural systems, and carbon credits as well. Okay, so I'm going to give you a few examples. I'll just check in on time. I don't know how we're doing. What time do we normally... Connie, what time
do
we normally...
Five or 10 minutes, is that good? And then,
yeah.
And then we can have questions.
Okay.
Yeah.
In that case, I'll probably do one example. I'll do Peru, and then I'll give you a quick idea of Madagascar. Then you see how we do things. Well, so I'll do Peru. I'll give you an idea of where we're going, and then if you've got questions, if you're interested in the fund structure or the deals, I can come back and give more examples. Sounds okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'll just ask, is there any clarification questions at this stage anyway? Any complete loss of idea?
I'm a bit confused. So
yes.
If I got loads of money,
yes,
wanted to invest in what you're doing, would I be invested in a fund which is a portfolio of things, or would I be invested in a project, in some sort of investment within
the project?
Yeah.
Yes, that's a good question. So, and sorry if that wasn't clear. So our role as a fund is to create a portfolio. You invest in us, and you're getting returns from that portfolio.
So I look at the risk of the portfolio level, not on any individual.
Correct.
Not like look at Peru.
You wouldn't have to worry about the risk on any individual
right.
deal. It's the profile. Interestingly, the way this works is that people were actually investing in us before we had the deals.
Yeah.
So they didn't know what we were going to end up with. But we had a document which quite clearly defines the scope of what we can and can't invest in. So they would have an idea of what would come. But then they trust us to actually go out and find the deals and manage them.
And in your portfolio, do you have any land type?
No.
Okay.
Was there a clarification?
Just
at the back
a clarification.
Or? Yeah.
Thing, but I wouldn't want to.
So do you pitch to them what the likely return on investment is at the end of the period for them? Or?
Yeah. So I mean, we have to be quite careful about talking about specific numbers, because often they can get taken out of context, particularly when you're talking about a portfolio approaches, which might be quite different to what's actually in any one deal. But in the impact investment space, you've got sort of people who will happily have no return, just have a go, and if you lose it, it doesn't matter, versus the real sort of commercial end. I think we're more on the commercial side, because that's where we see the scale. It will take a little bit more risk to try and get that in these type of activities I'll talk about. But we call it like close to commercial rates of return. We're not what you class as concessional financing, so we're not giving 2% loans for 10 years or something. So yeah, just to make this all a bit real, here's one example deal that nicely combines quite a few of the elements of what we do. So if you can imagine yourself now in the lowlands Amazonian rainforest in Peru, the town of Puerto Maldonado has the interoceanic highway running off it. It also has the Tambopata Reserve National Park area just off that, and a buffer zone running through here. Now this slide's actually from, this picture actually shows the pink in deforestation. This is from a couple of years ago. If you had this now, I think a lot more of this has gone, because there's been a real gold mining boom in this part of Peru that's been something our project is having to deal with. But we had some challenges here. So the first is this road, the mining, the expansion of deforestation towards the park, and a lack of productivity in this area. We had some opportunities as well. So a local NGO called IDARE have an administration contract for this park. That gives them the right to manage the park, taking the government's role to a large extent, but also the responsibility to fundraise for it. So they're charged with getting that. And there's also globally an increase in demand for fine flavour cocoa as quality and productivity is dipping in traditional production areas, particularly at the west coast of Africa. So there was an opportunity here to do a Red Plus project. I won't have time to explain all that if you're not familiar, but it's avoiding deforestation and claiming carbon credits for that as a mechanism for generating returns for the activities that IDARE were doing in protecting this park and developing the buffer zone. And then we also, to try and help start creating an economic fence of deforestation, against deforestation in this buffer zone, are investing in the establishment of a cooperative, a new cooperative for cocoa, and planting up to 4,000 hectares of agroforestry systems so that people can make good livings without intruding any further into the national park, restoring what's generally degraded pasture lands in the process. So how all this works from a finance point of view, we made a loan of 6.2 million euros, which sat alongside a grant made from a donor, which we're still actually looking for at the moment, if anyone has 2 million. That went to the NGO IDARE. Now, IDARE are a development and conservation organization, but they don't have the specific expertise to set up and manage cocoa cooperatives. So they brought in a Canadian Peruvian organization called Eco Tierra, who that's their job, to establish co-ops and market the cocoa. IDARE, as I mentioned, they manage the park and also do the legwork on the ground in terms of planting forestry. In terms of making a return, well, the Red Plus element generates an asset in terms of verified carbon units, so that's carbon credits to the VCS and CCB standard. We're also producing revenues now from cocoa sales from the cooperative. So in terms of repaying Alphelia's investment, we use the sales of VCUs to repay the loan until that's repaid. Then we enter into a profit sharing with them. So once we cross the threshold, then we'll start distributing so that us and the IDARE and essentially the government and the National Park are sharing in those profits. And we also, for the investment that we've made in the cooperative, we take a percentage of revenues for a period of time. The idea is to leave them set up and self-sustainable by the time we exit, so they can go on and get other types of finance after we've gone. So in terms of impact, there's 30 high conservation species that are in the park. We've avoided over 2 million tonnes of CO2 emissions so far from the avoided deforestation, and got over 600 hectares of cocoa planted to date. The cooperative's up and running and has started to have its first harvests now, but there's still a number of years to run on the project. So I had some other deals I told you about, but I fear we're running out of, I was ambitious and we're running out of time. So what I might do, I'll just spend 2 minutes giving you the our vision and where else we're going, because this might spark a few of the questions for people. So our small company, Alphelia, was recently acquired over the summer by a bigger fish called Mirova. And Mirova are part of a group called the Natixis Global Asset Management Group. So this is a big asset manager with 900 billion euros under management. And they've taken a stake in Alphelia, so we have this new combined entity, Mirova Alphelia. With that, we're going to launch a second version of the climate fund. So here at the bottom, the Alphelia Climate Fund 2. Try raise another 100, 150 million euros, dollars for this type of activity. With Mirova already had them, part of the reason for their acquisition of ours was that they already had a mandate from the UNCCD, so the Conference to Combat Desertification. They already had the mandate to run the Land Degradation Neutrality Fund, which is will be up to $300 million fund to invest in, to be honest, quite similar activities, so land restoration and avoided degradation activities. So under our new entity, Mirova Alphelia, we'll be managing that with them. We received a $35 million equity grant from equity investment, sorry, from the Green Climate Fund, combined with EIB investment, that takes that to $50 million to invest into Madagascar. That'll be focused on sustainable ag and renewable energy. And also, we're taking a dip in the ocean with the Sustainable Oceans Fund, which should be launching next year as well. So that'll be another $50 million. So all these four funds, as well as the Alphelia Climate Change Fund that we're running at the moment, should all be online next year. And I think we'll be about two-thirds of the way to our $1 billion deployed for nature target that we've set ourselves. So. Like I said, I've an example of a Cookstove project. I didn't get to talk about a cattle intensification project, and also the innovations around the structuring of the fund for Madagascar. So if anyone has any particular questions, we can maybe talk about some of those details on a glass of wine. But yeah, otherwise happy to take questions.
Thank you.